Welcome to the show. I'm Jordan Harbinger. As always, I'm here with my producer, Jason DeFilippo. Today, really excited to have Dr. Drew Pinsky on the show. He's been doing radio for something like 30 years. I grew up with Loveline, just like many of you. In fact, that's, Jason, probably where our entire generation kind of learned where things were, what things were happening to our body, how we were supposed to use them, how we were not supposed to use them. That kind of stuff.
Totally.
All comes from Dr. Drew. And what's really funny is I don't see him as that much older than me right now. And so when I was 13 listening to Loveline, he was like in his 20s or early 30s or something like that, which is incredible.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's like, I think Dr. Drew is like, you know, a contemporary of mine. I'm 47 and he can't be that much older than me. But I remember sitting in my car in my 20s at like midnight waiting for it to come on just so like my girlfriend and I could listen and really get some good info out of him. But now I'm just like, oh, you know, I could just sit down and have a beer with him like he was one of my homies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And it's fun to hang out with him and Adam Carolla, of course. And I love learning to read between the lines with people. And that was kind of my intro to all this, was how Dr. Drew was able to do that on the show. He just really got to the heart of issues. He's my number one radio influence, which should come as a surprise to pretty much nobody. And today, we'll explore how Dr. Drew reaches to the heart of an issue in seconds with his callers. This is practice, of course, but we'll learn how else this develops. And we'll discuss the idea that people who have it all can be dealing with the same stuff as everyone else. And we'll be getting personal here with Dr. Drew. We'll also learn how we can spot addict behavior in others and even in ourselves. This and much more with one of my favorites here, Dr. Drew. There are worksheets with every episode, including this one, if you want to learn how to really hammer the stuff home that we talked about here today. Those worksheets are in the show notes at jordanharbinger.com/podcast. So don't forget to check out Dr. Drew on Adam and Drew on Podcast One and in the Podcast One app, and his own show, The Dr. Drew Show, also on Podcast One and in the Podcast One app. Now, here's Dr. Drew. I grew up with Loveline, just to make you feel old.
Done.
I grew up with Loveline.
Done and done.
And you really do reach to the heart of the issue with the callers. And I always thought that was so interesting. Mm. And I remember talking with other FM show hosts that I'd met over the years and satellite hosts when I was on satellite. And I was like, how do these people do that? You know, because it's almost like it's almost like a psychic level of...
Yeah, it has that quality.
...reading between the lines. And for a while, I thought, some of these are probably fake. And there was one that I thought was fake.
Well, I can usually tell fake.
Can tell fake?
Yeah, that's pretty easy because you feel that in your gut right away. It just, things don't line up. You're like, okay, something's not right.
Oh, I mean, I thought you had people that were calling in and then you would read them. This is a long time ago. I don't think that now, obviously. But there was one that I thought, like... How is this? It's like a movie script. This person was saying a bunch of crap, didn't make any sense. Yeah. And then you said something along the lines of, is there someone else in there I can talk to? And then they were like,
oh,
sure.
Yeah, I could tell it was a multiple. Yeah, that's a pretty easy thing for me to tell.
Because how do you do that? That was incredible. It's a multiple personality disorder.
Yeah. I'm not doing that much of that work on the radio right now,
yeah,
so I'm not as honed as I was. But I remember I would get like this icy feeling, and it would be your question was, how do you do this? Well, you listen with your whole body.
Okay.
You don't listen with your ears. I mean, your ears are part of it. So you're super focused. You're listening to the vocal prosody, the vocal qualities. You're listening to the affect being communicated by that. You're listening to the words and the story, and then you're listening to your body's reaction to it. And I could really tell how my body reacted. It would just tell me that it's one of these. When it reacted like that, I knew it was one of two things. It was either multiple or bogus, one or the other. And I just had a feeling. I know it's when you're talking about, call you're talking about, because I had this very strong feeling. I thought, oh, no, this one's multiple. I could just tell.
Are you detecting the switch in personality that the person has, or are you getting that this person has this disorder before they switch personalities?
Before they switch. There's something about them. They tell me about their trauma or something, or they seem dissociated in some way to me. Mm-hmm. And that, again, that disconnect I feel like literally in my body. And so that informs me.
What does dissociated mean for people who do not?
Dissociation is what happens in the setting of trauma, essentially. When you know, we have these, what's called this Jacksonian dissolution, which is our body, as we get more and more stressed or distressed, we break down into lower and lower sort of strategies within our evolutionary biology. So we start with fight or flight. If we get about to be attacked, we go fight or flight. And then we go from fight or flight to freeze, which is a freeze response, which is sort of a way of conserving energy and anticipating attack. When you can't escape, it's apparently a higher level of survival. And then finally, there's psychological sort of survival, which is with that dissociating from the situation. People will describe hovering above it, or, you know, blacking out, or, you know, all kinds of different ways. And young kids that are severely traumatized, when their body is the source of the misery, will sort of cut off and dissociate from their body.
Interesting.
And then their body becomes all kinds of trouble to us internists later.
Sure.
Not just from the manifestation of medical problems, but they experience everything that comes out of their bodies as overwhelming and disorganized. So they'll describe it as pain or misery. They can't quite get it. Unfortunately, my profession isn't really taught on this, but I spent a lot of time working with people like this. And I just found you have to stop them and go, stop. What exactly? Because they'll just go pain. You go, okay, hold on. You said pain, but then you described weakness. So let's go here. What is this? And you have to really break it down for them, because they can't process it. It just overwhelms them. And there's a part of the brain called the insular cortex that probably is the source of all that chaotic misery.
Man.
And literally, when we dissociate, your brain doesn't wire. So trauma therapies are all about getting access to those disconnected parts and bringing them back into the integrated whole.
So the fight or flight, that's anxiety. A lot of people have that, right? Among other things, it can be anxiety.
Fight or flight is literally it's a sympathetic autonomic response. Anxiety includes a sympathetic response.
Okay.
So.
And then the freeze thing we've heard about, that dissociation seems a little more abstract, because when I read about trauma or when people describe it, and I think this is one of the problems when people don't talk about trauma for years and then they do, people don't believe them all the time because they say, oh, I'd repress these memories. And people who don't have that go, oh, that's bullshit.
Yeah.
You suddenly remembered this?
And it's more than repressed memories. It's a feeling that it doesn't bother me anymore. I need to forget about this. Because they want to push, your body wants to push it back. So it no longer remains, it's no longer an explicit memory, but it becomes an implicit memory in your body. So your body becomes the source of the memory, and you can develop things like PTSD, where it's always remembering it in the body's response.
That sounds terrible.
Yeah, it's awful.
That's truly awful. Yeah. So you get practice reading people course.
Yes. We didn't talk to a lot of multiple types. Yeah. And people, we can go, no, and please don't attack me for even using the term dissociative identity or multiple personality. People argue whether that really exists. But you know what I'm talking about. A severely dissociative individual.
Yeah, yeah. I misuse the term. You're just doing that for the sake of clarity.
I'm doing that for the sake of not having to deal with the trolls online.
I noticed that you deal with a lot of criticism. In fact, what was I watching? Yeah, Celebrity Rehab. And as soon as one of those people 10 years later passes away, it's your fault somehow.
Right, correct.
Yeah.
I die of heart disease. Still my fault.
Right, still your fault. Or Teen Mom, you're doing a reunion show.
Hosting. Not their doctor. I'm spend a day when I host and use my physician skills a little bit to interview them. Not their doctor. I offer them, I offer myself as a resource to them. I can't practice medicine across state lines. No. They're not my patients. They all have social workers and doctors and things that take care of them. I need to fix them.
Right. And if they get a DUI 5 years that celebrity or that Teen Mom, how dare you?
Right.
How do you deal?
It's weird.
How do you deal with that?
And I used to be exquisitely sensitive to criticism because I wanted to be perfect and do only good, only good, only good, only good.
Yeah.
And I remember when Adam and I wrote our first book, it was just sort of a advice book years ago. And we just wanted to make a difference. You know, we wanted to help. And I remember it was the beginning of Amazon, and you were allowed to have comments from readers in your little book section.
Oh, man.
I was devastated by some of the things people were saying. And what they were saying then was nothing compared to what goes on these days. I mean, nothing. And I was so hurt and so upset and so affronted professionally, and like my reputation had been harmed. As a physician, your identity is tied up in doing that job.
Sure.
And so it hurt as a person. And now you get used to the pummeling.
It seems like it would be tough to get used to that. I know one of the things.
And you have to find your compass. You know, you have to always go, I'm doing what's right. I'm doing what's good. And I have to trust my instincts. I have to trust what I know to be good and right and just keep going. And what people think about it, just like Teddy Lamar said, do it anyway. Just keep moving.
I think you said something about a doctor who was treating Hillary Clinton. It wasn't even about
her.
Yeah. It was like about the doctor treating her.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It was just like, oh, Dr. Drew hates Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened.
Let's tear him apart.
That's exactly what happened. And then when they decided, this is how messed up the press is. So we had decided to stop my HLN show about a month before that whole thing went nuts. So we stopped the show about 3 weeks after that. He was fired because
he got fired. Yeah.
We had nothing to do with it. Nothing whatsoever.
That's insane.
And people don't care about the facts. They do not care about the facts. And
I mean, there are people when they write to me and they disagree with something, I try to entertain them via email, Twitter, whatever. But if I look at your Twitter after you disagree with something and you say, hey, look, there's no real evidence the earth is round, I just can't even – because we're not going to get to that ground level whether the ground is flat or round.
Yes.
We're not going to get to that level in any short period of time.
And I, you know, I've sort of learned that when people have these sort of strange ideas, it's not about convincing them otherwise using rational thought or evidence-based inquiry. It is because then you get a backfire effect oftentimes, you know, where they'll double down in other crazy areas.
Sure.
That can be worse than whatever it was you were fighting about. And so I think I've not had the opportunity to really duke this one out, but I think what has to be discussed is people's worldviews, not the facts of the issue at hand, but what are your worldviews? Why do you not believe these things?
Yeah.
And that I imagine a flat earther's worldview is the world's an unplaced safe. People lie to me. The government is some evil institution and NASA is part of the government. Therefore, I can't believe them. Therefore, if somebody is somebody I can trust, shows me evidence, I'm going to believe that. As opposed to my worldview where trigonometry and calculus and physics work and where we can explain that mathematically. And if my worldview needs to change, well, this phone I'm holding suddenly stops working.
Floats upwards.
Yeah, it floats upward. All these lights don't work. I mean, magically, all the things that are part of my worldview in application work. So I'm going to stay with them.
A lot of people say that they don't, I don't care what people think. I don't care.
Yeah.
I don't have any opinion about that. Oh, haters going to hate or whatever.
Yeah.
I don't really believe that everyone thinks that way.
Of course. Well, if you really do, you're a sociopath, right?
Yeah, that's true.
Right.
That's
so,
true.
So you, of course, we care deeply about what other people think. And our very self emerges in intersubjective context, right? Without other people, we don't exist. So to, you know, if everybody hated or everybody, you know, disdained or thought ill of, that would not feel good. I don't care who you are unless you're a sociopath or a severe narcissist. But to be able to sort of have equanimity, you know, given the world we live in, I advocate for that because it's just the way it goes now. It's just, there's just negativity no matter where you go. But usually if there's negativity, there's also some positive. You have to start trusting that if you're moral and personal compasses lined up.
You're listening to The Jordan Harbinger Show with our guest, Dr. Drew Pinsky. Stick around and we'll get right back to the show after these important messages.
This episode is sponsored in part by The Great Courses Plus. Knowledge. I can't say the beginning of this, Jason, without thinking of that YouTube guy. Knowledge unlocks many doors in life. It's important to keep learning, and I do that in part by streaming The Great Courses Plus. It's a great way to build on information we already know, hear from the show, or discover new interests. And Jason, you were learning something from The Great Courses Plus, at least one thing. What were you working on again?
I was working on my chess game.
That's right. How did that go?
Pretty well. Well, I learned some really good opening tactics, and I just don't have anybody to play with, so it's a little difficult, so I just do it online now, but I learned a lot about chess. It was fantastic.
Bam Bam can't play chess?
No, her little paws can't move those pawns.
That's too bad. Well,
yeah.
Either way, you can do things by yourself with The Great Courses Plus as well. You don't have to have a chess partner, you don't have to play online, although you can learn about human behavior, investing, writing and grammar, playing the guitar. There are thousands of lectures to explore, and they also have an app where you can stream just the audio in case you don't want to watch somebody tell you things on a screen, because I understand how that goes. That's why I do audio-only shows. I recommend checking out their course on behavioral economics. We talked about this a lot on the show. This is when psychology and economics collide. So we're talking key motivators in our decision-making, insight into positive and negative effects our personal biases have on the choices we make. Sound familiar? It's a topic near and dear to our hearts here on the Jordan Harbinger Show. And they've got thousands of courses like this. So enjoy a free trial with unlimited access to the entire Great Courses Plus library. Start your free trial. Sign up through our special URL today, Jason.
They would be signing up at thegreatcoursesplus.com/Jordan. Remember that. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/Jordan.
Support for the Jordan Harbinger Show comes from our friends at Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, America's premier home purchase lender. Let's talk about buying a home. It can be one of the most important purchases you'll ever make. But today's fluctuating interest rates can leave you with unexpected higher payments, which can turn a great experience into an anxious one. That's why Quicken Loans created their exclusive power buying process. Here's how it works. They check your income, assets, and credit to give you a verified approval. This gives you the strength of a cash buyer, making your offer more attractive to sellers. Once verified, you qualify for their exclusive Rate Shield approval. They'll lock your interest rate for up to 90 days while you shop for your new home. Then, once you've found the one, if rates have gone up, your rate stays the same. But if rates have gone down, you get to keep that new lower rate. Either way, you win. It's the kind of thinking you'd expect from America's largest mortgage lender.
To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/Forbes. Rate Shield approval only valid on certain 30-year purchase transactions. Additional conditions or exclusions may apply. Based on Quicken Loans data in comparison to public data records. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLSConsumerAccess.org number 3030. Thanks for listening and supporting the Jordan Harbinger Show. To learn more about our sponsors, visit jordanharbinger.com/advertisers. And if you would be so kind, please drop us a nice rating and review in iTunes or your podcast player of choice. It really does help us out. If you want some tips on how to do that, head on over to jordanharbinger.com/subscribe. Now let's get back to Jordan and Dr. Drew Pinsky.
So as a personality that's highly visible, how do you deal with criticism, taking it as feedback or taking anything as positive or negative feedback? Because it's, of course, it's really tempting to go, all right, all the people who say the Jordan Harbinger Show is great, they're clearly, they got their head on straight. But this one person who says, screw you because of this, that, and the other thing, well, he's a crazy person or I can't let that get to me. What I tend to do is I read feedback, both good and bad, and I look at the bad stuff and go, all right, is there a kernel of truth to the truth?
Yeah,
to
sure, this? If you
it
can.
It drives my wife freaking crazy because she's like, why are you still thinking about this guy?
Well, if you're still thinking because he upset you, then that's one thing. But if he upset you because there was something in there that rang true, that's tough. That's hard.
It's hard to make that determination in the moment, though.
Very hard.
I have to set it aside, come back to it in a week, and go, all right. Because in the moment, I'll read somebody's email and go, well, you know what? Screw this guy. But then I'll read it in a week, and I'll say, oh, no, this person's unreasonable. Or, oh, you know what? I was upset because that is true.
And sometimes it's the style with which they approach it that you can't get past.
A lot of tone deaf emails.
If they're angry or whatever, hostile, aggressive, it's hard to hear it. But, you know, Corolla criticizes me for being too much adaptive, listening to people too much.
I've been there when he's done that.
Yeah. So, but that's just me. I mean, I really try to take input from the world and see if there's something useful there. I don't know.
It's kind of tricky. It's a tricky balance. Especially, I looked at your Twitter. You have like 3 million Twitter followers. You can't listen to those people. You can't listen to 99% of those people.
I can't respond to them, which is what's really weird. Because as a clinician, you're not allowed to respond. You can't say anything or do anything that could adversely impact on somebody. So you can't throw back.
Oh, so you just, if someone's like, you're a crazy person.
If somebody's horrible to me, I just got to like let it roll. Block.
Oh, man. I didn't realize you had ethical implications there.
And I just assume when it's really crazy that it's, somebody's not well. And so and you have to always think to yourself, hey, what do I represent to them that they, because that's not me. So what do I represent to them that, because I'm so,
jeez.
I mean, I'm politically moderate. I'm not, there shouldn't be anything really objectionable. So unless I represent.
Read your Wikipedia talk page and you will find.
Well, I'm not going
to. You are highly objectionable. No, don't read it, actually.
Right.
It's a terrible advice.
What zone am I a problem in generally?
I'm not even sure.
Being a physician and using medication?
There was
But that's
that.
All we have as doctors. That's, what are we supposed to do? We have a knife and we have pharmacology.
Yeah, I don't
what
know.
Else would they like?
I think it's a lot of it is people misinterpreting things that you say.
Probably.
And I think that happens to everyone at a certain level.
Yeah.
Yeah, most people will never face the same level of vitriol that a public personality faces.
No, I never. And as somebody who's – I'm sort of shame-based already – and so I always think to myself, what have I done to contribute to this? Because I must be doing something to contribute to it. And so whenever And sometimes there's sort of repetitive cycles of abuse that I get from, and I thought, I must have created that. I must have done, contributed somehow.
But you're not advising that people think like this.
No, this is a weird thing I do. It's like, because I feel like we're, you know, essentially responsible for our reality, essentially. I mean, yeah. not entirely, but essentially. And one of the things you can do is look at your own contribution to everything. I mean, we contribute to pretty much everything that happens in our life. I'm not in, sometimes it's in a very, very, very small way. Sometimes it's in a very big way. I just want to make sure I'm not missing something or doing something that I shouldn't be doing.
I feel like we have that same, I hate to say syndrome because you're a doctor and I'm misusing that word.
No, it is.
It really is like that, yeah. Right? Mm-hmm.
It's sort of the opposite of the Dunning-Kruger effect, right?
Yeah.
Dunning-Kruger is where you have a cognitive sense that you know a lot when you know very little.
Right.
Or you have a great ability when you have crappy ability because you've never seen, you've never experienced anything more. If you've experienced a lot and have a lot of training, there's sort of the opposite, which is the imposter effect.
The imposter effect, yeah.
Yeah. And part of that is there's something wrong with me. I should be doing something different. You sort of feel a sense of shame or guilt all the time.
It is very common. What I always tell my audience is that the imposter syndrome, what's great about this is it's an indicator that you are probably a high performer or at least a deep thinker.
No, that's right. And it's sort of goes back to something, I think it was Einstein that said, like, the more you know, the more you know you don't know.
Yeah.
And part of that makes you feel like an imposter, even though – and plus, if you have sort of low self-esteem like I do, you sort of feel like, if I can master this stuff, I'm sure everybody knows
it. Sure, exactly. Yeah, that's very true. When I give talks to high schoolers and I say, who here feels like, you know, you're the only person who doesn't understand this, that, and the other thing? And the answer, they never raise any of their hands. And then I'll go give a talk to a bunch of, like, funded startups that are running – companies that are just at the beginning, they're doing really, really well. They're these unicorn funded startups or unicorn companies, social media companies, places where the founders have billions of dollars in options. And the whole room raises their hand and says, yeah, I feel like I'm the guy who doesn't belong here.
Yeah.
And so it's just so funny to see a room of high schoolers be like, no, I know a lot of stuff.
Yeah. Millennials are particularly guilty of this.
Yeah.
And so it's like, oh boy. Because the phone gives them a false sense of knowledge.
Yeah.
They have information. They don't have knowledge.
On the other hand, those same millennials are the ones running these companies, I'll tell you. Just older millennials, generally.
I'm sure there are ones amongst them that have the imposter as well.
Yes. Yeah. I think we can agree on that. I mean, you have kids, so I would imagine you saw a change in the generation as you raise your kids.
Yeah. I mean, I saw us, you know, the mistakes that our generation did. So just over parenting and over rewarding and worrying about esteem and stuff like that. Although I personally didn't worry too much about that. I was much more worried about education, and don't do drugs. Those were sort of my things.
Oh, yeah. You know? Yeah, the addiction. Man, you had a front row seat to all of that, not only given your profession, but hearing all these younger people calling on Loveline.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, think about it. We'd get, 30, 40 calls a night, and so we would hear exactly what was going on in real time. And strangely, recently, people have been asking for it again. McCroll and I both noticed, like, the last 6 weeks, people, like, a lot just say, hey, bring it back, please bring it back.
Oh, I was, you know, it's funny. I was going to ask if you're ever going to bring it back too.
I guess. Are we thinking about it? We could, or I don't know if Adam wants to or not, but it's certainly of need. I was working with some millennials a couple of, like, 2 weeks ago. I had, like, 300 or 400 of them I was talking to. And I started talking about STDs because there's been such an increase lately. And I saw them, their eyes kind of glaze over. And I was like, yeah, well, you know, how many, what about condoms? I could tell, huh? And so I said, wait a minute, how many of you are, what percent, show of hands, how many are using condoms? What percentage of millennials you figure using condom? How many percent in that room?
This is going to be depressing. 20%.
Zero. I couldn't find one. I could not find one who had used a condom. And then
That's insane. Then
I dealt with another group the next week and I asked the same question. Zero. So there's something going on now that's a little different.
That's crazy. When I was growing up, and everyone listened to Loveline, so I'm not saying it was Loveline that did this. Well, every single person used the condom.
Yeah, but there was the AIDS epidemic, and we've done such a great job with all that. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, STDs are on the rise again.
That's really bad news.
Yeah.
And so stupidly avoidable.
I know.
So ridiculous. Know. Unbelievable. Gah.
Hey, but good times.
Yeah. yeah. There's that. I love the idea of reading between the lines, and I love the idea of being able to read people that is outside of practice. And
wait, what do you mean
outside of just
common discourse,
getting reps in, like, you know, if you're on Loveline for how long did that show run? Like
35 years.
So if the first 5 years you were wrong a lot, the last 5 years, you're probably never wrong. Almost.
Right, right.
So is it just the practice, or is there some other skill set that, like, if you were training somebody else to be
that
the
show?
Adam or you yeah. on Loveline, what would you
do? Well, I started focusing my training in areas that would help that. You got to remember, because I started doing the show when I was a medical student.
That's right.
Last year
that's right.
in medical school. And then as I came on through residency, I started working in a psychiatric hospital and just got interested in things that were coming up all the time on the radio show. And I would really pile into those topics and got good at it. I knew a lot about them, and they were coming up commonly. So I made sure I knew what I was talking about. And if I were advising somebody to be able to do that show, I would have them do a medicine followed by a psychiatry residency. I would go good medical school, medicine residency, then a psychiatry residency. That person could handle the show.
There you go. Yeah, because whenever I listen to your answers on that show, or anyone's answers on that show, you or Adam, it's always so – there's a lot of insight. That, unless Adam's just making fun of him. Those answers aside, there's a lot of insight there that you can't get from
And
that.
He was a good study too. You know, he's good instinctively, right? So he always said, you know, if I were studying polar bears and I studied 30 of them, I'd pretty much know how polar bears work. You know, and so he got pretty good at sort of hearing the stories over and over again.
Yeah, I suppose that's true. I've always found when I did my show on satellite, we had live callers asking us similar questions, I guess, because – Loveline was probably off the air and they had nowhere else to go. I always was able to really solve only people that had kind of my own problems. Thankfully, I had so many of my own.
That's good. You had experience.
But I'd worked so hard at solving those that I'd put so much time That's into good. Thinking about them, right?
That's good.
Is your instinct to solve other people's problems or to give that advice, I should say, you're not really solving the problem. Were you mostly relying on conscious study, or were you kind of able at one point to just go, all right, all these things, your subconscious brain just plotting everything in? And out comes the answer. Like, how mechanical was that at the right. end?
It initially, like every skill set, it was initially study, 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 experience, 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 like for, you know, a decade. And then it became a little more instinctive, like where I could trust whatever was going to come out of my mouth, I could pretty much trust it. And that really started happening with dealing with drug addicts out in the clinic, because they pull you into a vortex. They're bullshitting. They're upset. They're, oh my God. And you have to pull out of this mess something real and reach them. And I got to the point where I would just trust anything came out of my mouth. And sometimes I'd sort of shudder. I'd like, oh God, what did I just say?
Yeah.
And it was never wrong. And it towards, you know, the last 15 years, 10 years of my practice.
What do you mean by vortex? Like, I'm trying to make this applicable because I think there's people listening right now who go, oh yeah, my brother's doing drugs.
Yeah.
How do you know if you're in this vortex?
You feel spinning, like your emotions are spinning around. You don't know what you've done, what you've not done. You feel responsible, but you're not. You just feel you can feel confused. It's just like an emotional vortex. And they create drama and chaos as a way of sort of smoke screening so they can keep using. So that's just kind of how it works.
Jeez. What do we look for?
Well, I mean, it depends what age and what drug and stuff. But whenever I a lot of stuff happens in my mind's eye. Like I hear things and music and sounds and things that I know mean something to me. Like if I hear the sound, you know, the little cartoon with these guys, yugga, 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 yugga.
Yeah, sure.
I know I'm with a drug addict.
Okay.
When I hear that yugga, yugga sound in my head, I'm up. Drug. Somebody's doing drugs. I just know it.
So that's your brain doing that?
That's
because
my brain.
Spouting crap.
I'm just going to be sitting here listening to somebody going, huh, huh, huh. And all of a sudden I go, yuggity, yuggity. I go, oh, okay. I got it. It's like, well, I can stop listening now and just start asking what they're taking, how much they're on, that kind of stuff.
That makes sense. Because I remember listening to a call again in prep for this. And it was something like this woman was talking about. It was a relationship question.
Yeah. Yeah.
And she was saying, well, you know, this happened, this other thing happened. And then you went, when's the last time you used heroin?
Yeah.
And she was like, well, I'm not calling about that. Has nothing to do with this.
Yeah.
And I went, how the hell did you do that? It was like a real life.
I just knew.
Cold read.
Yeah. And then again, that's just, you know, people that do these drugs have sort of characteristic behavior patterns, behavior and relationship and thing. And I just can, when I see it, I know it. I just know it's there.
It's like a fingerprint. They can't know. It's like an accent. They call and they go,
yeah,
yeah. And they tell you this story and you're like, you're Irish. And it's
yeah.
like, well, yeah.
yeah. Yeah. It's an accent. It's strangely more than that. It's they usually are tells. Like they'll say something and I'll go, wait a minute. And there's sometimes I can't even explain why I know it. I can't. And I just know it. When I know that somebody's using drugs or has an alcohol history or something, I just know it.
Yeah. It's like a superpower.
It is a little bit of a weird superpower, and it's because people that do these things have different. They fit differently in relationships. You know when you're fitting with them. You know when you're with them, and people lie and bullshit constantly, both on the radio and in real life in the clinic. And when I'm seeing somebody as an outpatient or whatever, inpatient. And so I have to learn not to listen, but not to expect truth. And if something's not lining up for me, to really again start listening with my whole body and see what comes up.
That is, it is never ceases to impress. And it reminds me of the, when I started answering the dating questions a lot on satellite radio, far less cool of a superpower, by the way. Somebody would say something like, oh, I'm trying to date this kind of girl and that kind of girl. Or, I had all these relationships with these strippers and stuff. And then I'd be like, oh, so you don't get along with your mom? And it's like 99
right.
times.
Right. So, that's far a tell, more right? But yeah, well, it's a tell. It's like, they're dating strippers all the time. Yeah. I wonder what that's about. And you cannot underestimate the value of what's called therapeutic wonderment. Like, what's that all about? Even though you know something, I wonder what that is. And you'll hear me do that all the time. People can't resist. They'll just come out with some real information then. And that's when you, and on the other hand, if you go at them, shields up, right. They're shutting down. This is the weird misconception people have in this country, that you can somehow attack people or out them in some way, that you're going to change their behavior, give them insight by it's the most bizarre thing I've ever seen. I think there's too much daytime television.
I think that's probably true. Yeah.
Literally. I think it's like that's not how humans work at all. At all.
Something you had mentioned probably, I don't know, 20 years ago now was that people kind of want to tell you what's going on, especially if they call into a radio show. But generally, people want to tell somebody what's going on. And I don't remember exactly how you phrased it, but it was something along the lines of your therapeutic wonderment comment got me. I think it was you say something like, do you have a theory about why you might be like that? And generally, people have a really good theory that is exactly –
yeah,
or at least close to why.
Yeah, what's
this
that? I just ask it more simply. I just go, what do you think that's about? What do you think? And then they'll give you good information. Then they'll tell you something. It may not be the whole story, but they'll give you something good.
We'll be right back with more from Dr. Drew Pinsky after these brief announcements.
This episode is also sponsored by ButcherBox. This is high quality, healthy protein you can trust. 100% grass fed and finished beef. Free range organic chicken, heritage breed pork. That's a old world pork before they bred out all the fat and flavor to make it the other white meat. This is, the way pigs are meant to be. That should be their slogan.
It's really funny. I was talking to the guys at ButcherBox and they're like, remember when you were a kid and everybody would give you applesauce with your pork chops because they were so dry? They're like, yeah, we fixed that with our pork chops. These are like really old school pork chops. And I got to admit, they are. They're incredible. Have you had the pork chops yet? Because if you haven't, get on it.
No, I haven't. I had a bunch of the bacon. Awesome. I had a bunch of the beef. Awesome. And what I love is that it's delivered to your door on dry ice. Free shipping anywhere in the 48. Oh, sorry, Canadians and Hawaiians and Alaskans. Both of you.
Yeah.
Both of you. Sarah Palin and the other person that lives there. The taste is unbelievable, though. There's a huge difference in taste between animals raised on pasture and those fed in like these concentrated feedlot grain operations. And it's exclusive stuff. I know that sounds weird with meat, but this type of high-quality meat is actually hard to find. And for those people who live in what's called a food desert, it's near impossible. And for those who live in big cities with expensive supermarkets like Whole Foods or whatever, the prices ButcherBox has are pretty much impossible to beat. So we've got a great offer. You get the offer includes free bacon. All right. So just let that sink in. And you get $20 off your first box by going to butcherbox.com and using the discount code Jordan at checkout. Jason, you want to repeat that for them?
Sure thing. Go to butcherbox.com and use the discount code Jordan to get $20 off your first box and that amazing free bacon. I'm telling you, that bacon is unbelievably good.
Oh, by the way, we are running a contest in concert with our partner Helio, which is an awesome book club, among other things. But we're giving away 3 signed books from Paul Jarvis, Chris Bailey, and Peter Bregman, and a coaching session with myself as well. And the Next Big Idea Club, a 1-year membership to the Next Big Idea Club, which includes a bunch of books as well. These books are everybody you've heard on the show. This is essentially a who's who of who you've heard on the Jordan Harbinger Show. Really great thinkers. These are going to be signed books that you're going to get. And of course, the coaching session with me, which I would hope is worth the price of admission, because all you got to do is go to jordanharbinger.com/helio. That's jordanharbinger.com/helio, H-E-L-E-O. And you just enter your email and your name, and you're entered to win the books and the coaching session with me.
Thanks for listening and supporting the Jordan Harbinger Show. Your support does keep us on the air. So for a list of all the discounts from our amazing sponsors, visit jordanharbinger.com/advertisers. And don't forget to check out our Alexa skill. Go to jordanharbinger.com/Alexa or search for Jordan Harbinger in the Alexa app. Now for the conclusion of our interview with Dr. Drew Pinsky.
Why is it that you're also a GP even now? You do TV, you got radio, you've got podcasts. Why still run a clinic?
Multiple reasons. One is most of these people are patients I followed for 30, 35 years. And so they're all like in their 80s and 90s, and at least in their 70s.
Okay.
And they have lots of interesting medical problems, which I like taking care of.
Okay.
They, you know, play the guilt card on me. You promised you'd stay with me till the end. You promised you'd be here all the way. And if I'm calling myself a doctor, I better be a doctor.
That's what I was wondering, yeah.
You know what I mean? And you'd be surprised how quickly you can pull out of the what's happening in medicine. It moves fast. And it's not just about reading the literature. It's about what's the practice is. And so I'm around peers. I talk to peers. I share things. I hear things. And so I get to kind of keep up on what's going on a little bit. Not the way I used to. I used to be like insane. I used to be like, leave me alone, practice medicine, and just we'll do a little television, radio, or something over here. But just leave me alone to practice medicine. I did that for years and years and years.
Last time you and I spoke was a couple of months ago. And you said you were thinking about just going back and doing medicine or going back and doing clinical work, and you weren't sure if you were.
Yeah, I was in a real bad mood. I don't know why. I'm still sort of there, but I have this fantasy that I'll just go back and become work in the hospital. Just go and work, just see patients.
Is that sort of escapism or I don't know?
It has something to do with what you were talking about earlier with all the negativity and stuff. It's like, if people are so negative and I can't help anybody and I'm such a piece of crap, I'll just go back and take care of patients. It's like, I know how to do that, and I'm good at it, so just go do it.
Let my old patients yell at me, not some turd on the internet.
Well, it's at least there I'm in a system, and I'm part, you know, it's just different. People won't attack you, and they just don't in real life.
Yeah, well, that's true. They don't have the cover of the interwebs behind them.
Yeah, I mean, what they do is if something goes wrong, they hire an attorney. That's a different thing.
Could be a little worse than a Wikipedia edit would.
Frankly, it's just more of a waste of time. Whenever I've been sued, I've been involved in malpractice suits, it's been the biggest waste of time. It's been ridiculous.
Yeah, you spend like $30,000, and then the judge goes, yeah, there's nothing here.
They never go to trial. Not stuff I'm involved with. I get stuff like I had a case once where this woman was in the locked ward of the psychiatric hospital, and she was so floridly psychotic they couldn't get near her to do her physical exam. So I was on call one night. They call me and they said, "Hey, this woman has another exam still. It's day three. Get up here, try to do it." I went, "Okay." And then they like a half hour later, they call me, go, "Something's changed in her too. You better hurry." I went, "I'm right there." Look at the chart. You can see these doctors trying to – too wild. Can't get her. You know, can't get vital signs. Can't get anything. And I go to her, and she is comatose. She's not responsive to deep pain. And I was like, well, this is not psychiatric. Whatever that was not psychiatric either. We got to get this woman out of here. And she had fasciculations in her arms, like these peculiar little muscular activities. And I thought, this is, I don't know if she's seizing. I don't know what's going on. This is neurological. This goes. Get her out of here. She ended up on a ventilator 4 hours later. She had encephalitis. So within 10 minutes of my arrival, I had saved her life, got her to the hospital, and she recovered with no sequelae, as far as I heard. Sued for delay in treatment.
Unbelievable.
Personally, yeah.
Unbelievable.
Another one, I was sued on a case for a patient, not my patient. I was aware of it because people were talking about the case on the unit. Difficult case. I don't want to get into it, but it was a patient that eventually died in hospice care. Like it was a patient that the family wanted to stay in the psychiatric hospital, so he had some quality of life towards the end. Again, sued for wrongful death. This guy had no chance of survival, wrongful death. Jeez. Why was I sued? Because when the patient was being discharged, I was sitting with his doctor, and the nurse leaned in and said, "Hey, Mr. So-and-so is being discharged." And his doctor said, "Thanks, Nurse So-and-so." And in the chart, the nurse reported patient discharge, Dr. Kerpinski and Dr. Smith aware.
Unbelievable.
That was the totality of my involvement in the case. Months of depositions.
That's, oh God, I was going to say they probably just threw it out right away. Nope.
They did after months of depositions.
Unbelievable.
We have to do the discovery.
Yeah, discovery. God, that's irritating just hearing about it, and I'm an attorney.
Yeah, I know. I was talking to Dax Shepard on his podcast, and he asked why I'd talked to my kids and said, don't do medicine unless you really have a calling. If you have a calling, it's the greatest thing in the world. But if you don't have that calling, it's difficult, it's painful. And these are the reasons. There's just so many reasons. It's just so painful to practice medicine these days.
That's super depressing. Lawyers can malpractice all day, and they basically just have to apologize, unless it's so egregious that a company will prove that they messed up. But you have to be terrible, generally, to have that happen. It's the opposite with doctors. You just have to be literally in the room.
You have to be unlucky or have not crossed some T.
Mm-hmm.
Like literally some documentation wasn't exactly what it should be. That's it. There's your smoking gun. You're screwed.
Jeez.
Yeah.
You mentioned before the self-esteem thing. And obviously you're successful. You're married. You're well-known. People love you. Obviously not everybody, as evidenced by
Wikipedia.
Apparently
a lot of people don't. Yeah.
You know, you got kids that are doing well. Self-esteem obviously doesn't care if you're successful.
Right. Self-esteem is something established, I think, by age 5, if I remember right.
Oh, that's depressing.
Yeah. And it turns out, I mean, you can enhance it and you can move it a little bit, but most of it is set early. And mine was bad. But it doesn't bother me. And I sort of use it. Like, it makes me double check myself. It makes me, you know, never feel like I've done enough or good enough. I might use it as a motivator, which is painful when you get a lot of negative stuff flying at you. But it's kind of nice if you want to motivate to do something good, it helps you.
How do you get to that point? Because I think there's probably somebody or a lot of people listening right now who go, yeah, I have low self-esteem. How do you use it as a motivator instead of just going, my whole life is going to be limited?
Here's what would be bad is if my life were falling apart or something and I had low self-esteem, that would be like a multiplier. Then it would cause me to tumble down the hill of feeling crappy. In terms of feeling good, it's like, well, you feel like you can never do enough, right? And I don't mind that. I if that tormented me, that would be bad. But I feel like I always have to check myself. I always have to make sure that if something bad happened, like I'm saying, I must have had something to do with it. So let's evaluate it because, hey, it's me and I'm no good. So therefore, I don't feel bad. It's not like I walk around feeling bad. It's just sort of a point of view almost, right? It's a perspective.
Yeah. But this never gets solved per se, right?
So they say.
Includes you, man.
I think what it is, you know, through years and years of therapy, it just doesn't bother you. It's just not troubling. It's just sort of a position, right? You get the negative or the positive pole. I got the negative pole, and it's okay. It's fine. It's just a position.
It is interesting that you were able to parlay it into something that is useful, because I think a lot of people who feel like they have, even if it's low self-esteem or something else, they feel like they're stuck with that and it's going to limit them forever.
It doesn't have to. No. I mean, Adam has it too. As we joke with each other all the time, is that we both have these very low self-esteems. And so it makes us like not talk about our own stuff and not spontaneously remember to promote things and stuff like that. Because it's like, it's my stuff. It's like, who wants to hear about that?
Well, if that's low self-esteem, then yeah. I got it too. Because my producer and my business partners are always like, dude, we've had this free mini course at advancedhumandynamics.com/level1 for like 3 months and you've never said anything.
There
about
it is.
It.
Now it's been said.
Finally, my self-esteem is intact now. How do you find out if you have that? Like, I know you're going to say you know about it, but
if you have low self-esteem?
Yeah. How do you know?
I imagine there are scales out there.
Sure.
I mean,
How did you find out, for example?
I always felt bad about myself.
Well, there's that.
Yeah. I mean, I think I probably started thinking about it when all the esteem literature came up. You know, people started talking a lot about esteem and enhancing esteem in young people and that kind of stuff. And that sounded like a good thing to me because I thought, well, there were times in my life when that did not feel good. When you're an adolescent and stuff and you have a low self-esteem, it's really hard to be effective. Yeah, but it also made me strive to do things to make myself feel better about myself and to succeed. And I think that's where sort of the workaholism comes in too. So it has a liability there.
Yeah. I definitely have the workaholism thing, and I think I got it from my dad just because he's a super hard worker. But there's also a part of me that wonders, wait a minute, do you try harder at everything to prove to yourself that it that you can do it because maybe there's a part of you that thinks, yeah, you probably can't do
this. Yeah, right. Yeah. And some of that, and that's can be very subtle and doesn't have to be overt low self-esteem. It can be just sort of, and it could be your dad. You're trying to impress some internal you know, representation of your dad. But
he's very much external and still around. Okay. And still,
no, but the reason we respond to it is that we internalize it.
Of course, yeah.
You know, and some people theorize. And yeah, that's okay. That's all right. I you know, it just if it gives you trouble, if it makes you feel bad, if it gives you symptoms, as it impairs your functioning, that's therapy time.
Okay. But did you ever try therapy for that?
11 years.
Oh, my God.
Not for that per se. I was having overwhelming anxiety. That was my main reason. At least that's my wife's reason for sending me. I always wanted to go. Yeah. I've always been fascinated by introspection and stuff. And I really did not know what I was doing or, you know, I was starting to work in a psychiatric hospital and I was starting to work in addiction medicine and stuff. And, you know, I knew what was going on intellectually, but I was getting taken advantage of, for lack of a better way of describing it, by certain kinds of patients. They were able to manipulate me and things and I couldn't figure out why. Mm. But I knew I was contributing. Again, I knew something I was doing. Years and years of therapy, I solved those problems.
Wow. Yeah. If I had millions of dollars to spend on, and this sounds weird, a hobby, I would get a therapist that was a rock star every day. I don't think there's any serious thing going on. I just want to do that kind
of thing. You need time. You need time too. So what you want to do is five days a week psychoanalysis. That'd be fantastic.
Wouldn't that be awesome?
Oh, if I had time and money for that, are you kidding me? I would do it this minute.
I don't know how many people really want to go to a psychoanalyst 5 days a week. I think we probably have some sort of weird.
To me, it'd be like better than a sensory deprivation tank or something. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that sounds like
exactly what I want to do.
It sounds like the most interesting thing I could possibly.
Yes, what could be more interesting than exploring your mind?
Yeah. So if anybody out there is listening to this and they want to volunteer for that,
I would do 3 days a week happily. I just don't have time for it. I don't have time. I that's another fantasy I have is one day I'll go back into analysis. So
there you go. Yeah. I think that stuff is fascinating because
I don't want to make a distinction for people what we're talking about. There's a difference between mental health and mental wellness and then sort of actualization or you know, that we need like a different set of terms for people that want to really fully fulfill the exploration of their minds and beings. And it's not, strictly speaking, a spiritual journey. It's a psychological journey. I mean, you may along the way discover, oh, I have some spiritual needs I need to attend to also. And if now we're spending our whole day meditating with analysts, that would be bizarre.
That seems less interesting to me, at least right now.
Yeah, me too.
I definitely would love the analysis. Speaking of, since we're talking about your emotional problems or whatever,
sure. Go right
on
ahead.
That note,
I'm all in.
I was listening to a show with a mutual friend of ours, Caleb Bacon.
Yeah,
this Man School show that you guys recorded, I don't know, half a decade ago or something now, probably.
A couple years ago, I think, yeah.
And you're recording while you're lifting weights.
Yeah.
And you had mentioned that you'd been lifting weights since you were, I don't know, 15 years old.
Yeah, 15, yeah.
Just religiously.
It doesn't feel religiously. It just feels like part of my life.
Yeah. Okay. Religious may be the wrong word.
Yeah.
I think maybe somebody, you or him, had used that word. But that you had OCD and anxiety around fitness because of something that I was not super familiar with, body dysmorphia. I've heard of it. Of course, I know what it is, but I never really thought that much about guys having this.
Oh, it's common. It's common. Body dysmorphia originally was preoccupations with little tiny aspects of the face. And then it became, that was the original description. People, you know, picking at skin and getting nose jobs and things like that. But it's become more generally in the common lexicon applied to how people see themselves in their body, particularly as it pertains to eating disorders, where people are never thin enough. They see a fat person, even though they're terribly thin.
Sure.
And it's just, you know, you see imperfections. I'm sort of being flippant about it. I don't really, really have it. But I have something. I have something that has me attend to that very regularly and try to be okay all the time.
Seems quite healthy.
Yeah. I'm using it. Again, it's another thing I seem to be using in a positive way. Even though it's part of my OCD and anxiety. It's all tied together because it's very OCD to be able to work out every day. That's only kind of OCD people can really do that. And it relieves my anxiety when I work out and I get sort of a meditative quality from it. So there's a lot of stuff to kind of, and I think I can tend towards sort of an exercise bulimia. Like if I eat too much, I want to work out more. Yeah. That's not a good impulse either.
No, that could be a lot of trouble. Yeah. Especially, your joints aren't going to get
My joints are, you know, I'm 60 this year, and my joints are getting a little messed up, and I'm worrying about that now. Yeah.
Yeah. No jujitsu for you then.
Have to get on growth hormone and steroids. That's all.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Sure. Didn't you used to work? Yeah, that was also part of that show. You used to work out at a gym a long time ago, and all the guys were asking you to prescribe steroids.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, a long time ago.
Yeah.
Right when I was getting my license, I heard what they were doing. They would come to me and ask for stuff, and the whole that back then, this is like the '80s. Massive denial that there was such a thing as steroids. In fact, the medical literature was they don't make you strong. Steroids, there's no reason they would do steroids. Yeah.
What?
Crazy.
Wow.
Read that literature from the 80s. Made me crazy because I heard and then saw what happened to them. I mean, Jesus. It's obvious.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
And it's like all they needed to do to disprove that particular theory was put one or, of course, a control group of people that don't use it and put a handful of people on it and watch them balloon in size.
I know. They
that's
would just go
ridiculous.
Yeah, it was ridiculous. It was so bizarre.
So that's what makes people maybe distrust modern medical literature.
Oh,
too.
Listen, there's lots of on the behavioral health side, there's lots of crappy literature. Almost all the addiction literature is crap. I mean,
really?
I shouldn't say it quite that glibly. A lot of addiction literature is crap because they don't do unbiased, they don't do observed screening, they don't screen for multiple substances, they believe what the patient says, they rely on questionnaires. Patients lost a follow-up or just lost a follow-up instead of relapsing, and the durations are all too short, way, way, way too short.
What are some of the biggest myths that you think that people believe or that are persistent in medical literature right now that people take as, well, this is the common belief that you think
is that the only way to treat an opiate addict is with replacement therapy.
So like methadone or whatever.
Methadone or Suboxone. That you are a dangerous person if you do anything else, and that is a terrible message. Also, that an average physician with limited experience with addiction should be able to prescribe to 250 addicts with replacement. I know what I'm doing. I don't think I can handle 30. It's
really?
They are very difficult patients to properly treat. 250 is nuts. That's absolutely insane.
The caseload of 250
people. With of active addiction trying to treat with replacement harm avoidance therapy, that's just insane.
Because you just can't give them enough attention.
They need a lot of attention. Yes, they need a lot of attention. They need a lot of time and a lot of intensity of services, and it's very difficult to deliver that properly.
This might sound like an obvious question or a simplistic question, but how do we know if we're addicted to something? Because I think a lot of people think I'm not. It's not drugs. I just like video games.
Right. So it's progression. I don't like the over deployment of the term addiction. You know.
Okay.
So be careful. I mean, I like to see a biological heritage. In other words, I like to see evidence that the gene is there that causes real addiction, you know, true addiction. And so family history of alcoholism, family history of drug addiction, particularly in first degree relatives, and then progression or preoccupation, progressive preoccupation in the face of adverse consequence, work or school, finance, health, legal, or relationships. So any of those areas of your life are being affected. And you're continuing, there's something wrong with that relationship with whatever you're doing. Most people, when they have a significant area of their life affected, they adjust course.
So this is a question that, again, I'm not sure you can answer. So what if there's somebody who does cocaine while they're at work and it's fine because they do their job well, there's no consequences to their relationship.
That might not be full on addiction. That might be drug abuse.
Drug abuse. Okay. Yeah. As opposed to addiction.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's somebody who's doing something that's dangerous.
Sure.
But I can't predict the course the way I can if it's the full disease of addiction.
Right. Okay. But drug. Okay. That makes sense. Because you don't really hear that separated. Right?
Well, now the DSM-5 separates it. It's 100 different ways.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess we just only hear about addiction or people who use get lumped into that, which
people, this is what bothered me about a lot of the suicides recently is this. Oh, depression, suicide. Each one of those cases was very different, very, very different.
You recently mentioned that you weren't sure what was next for you, and we sort of touched on this a little bit, but how do you go about making a transition after doing something like this for so long? Something like radio, television for so long. Is your identity not tied so strongly into this?
Yeah, my identity is tied to sort of everything I do, I guess. But I have no blueprints for what I'm doing. It's all a big improvisation. It's an experiment. And so I'm looking for a door to go through or a couple doors to go through and trying to figure out which one to go through and how fast to go through. And I can always tell when I'm antsy. It's like I'm not satisfied. I don't feel like I'm doing anything. I need to create something different. I'm definitely in that mode right now. Definitely. And I'm a workaholic.
Yeah.
And so when I start getting not crazy busy, I miss it. Now, I don't want to be crazy busy all the time, but I wouldn't mind for 6 months being crazy busy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Super crazy busy. I don't know what it looks like, though. I don't know what that's going to be. I just don't know yet. I've got a lot of different things, a lot of shit I'm throwing at the wall, a lot. And none of it really sticks right now.
Yeah.
So we'll see. Yeah.
Nice.
I'm looking for a new home for, I would love to do a talk show again. I got some, I really see how the HLN show, when we were doing it with an audience, that was something I really enjoyed doing. That was starting to take form. And so I would bring something like that back.
If only you didn't say those negative things about Hillary Clinton.
Hillary's doctors.
Oh, Hillary, yeah.
You know what I said, right?
No, like, I didn't
did that
know
come up in the Wikipedia thing, too?
No, maybe it was in there, but I could only skim your talk page. It was too depressing.
I'd done 20 minutes the night before on Don Lemon about, he was asking me about Donald Trump's mental health. And I was saying, well, you know, narcissism, maybe, I don't know, the mania, hypomania, I'm sure. And I was saying, you know, plenty of presidents have had mental health issues, Teddy Roosevelt, Lincoln, and we were just sort of talking about it. And so I went into my radio station the next day, and my boss said, hey, would you do 30 seconds? It was good. Do 30 seconds on it for our website. I said, yeah, did 30 seconds. And as I'm getting up, he goes, you know, maybe you ought to balance that out. You got 30 seconds on Hillary, something about her? And I go, well, as a matter of fact, they just released her medical record. And her doctors are doing to me is a little suspect, and I got some issues with something. She has a really serious – she had a stroke and a transverse sinus thrombosis in her skull. I mean, like really serious stuff I didn't know about. And I was shocked. And I was like – and they were – the way they were treating it, and the armor thyroid causes hypercoagulation, and I was worried that was maybe causing the problem. I mean, she had two clots in her leg and one in her brain.
Jeez.
And it was like, for God's sakes. And so I said, okay, I could do that. Well, next day, Drudge picks that up as doctor says, not fit, which was not what I said. I said, I'm wondering this and, you know, anyway, so it was terrible.
Just twisted it. What is it like to read something about you that is just totally false?
It's the worst feeling in the world. It's really a bad feeling, especially when you meant nothing by it other than trying to educate or explain something. And then you're accused of all kinds of sinister motivation or intent that's when I go, oh, Jesus, are they right? Am I something wrong with me? I always go into that mode. Like, and then I, of course, feel guilty that people are reacting to something I said in a way that has negative impact. It's not my intent.
Yeah. For me, that would drive me insane. Because I struggle to be as clear as possible on the show. I'm always trying to be very careful with my word choice a lot of the time. And you have to be even more so. I think as doctors
why do
and
I
lawyers.
Have to be more for? Yeah, you need to be as doctors and lawyers for sure. But why do I need to be more so? I'm exquisitely careful.
Oh, no. I just mean you have to be more so than me.
I don't know.
Not more so.
These days, everybody needs to be.
Well, that's true. Everybody does.
But I'm happy to be.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And here's what drives me crazy is if I've done or said something wrong, I am delighted to adjust course because, you know, it's me. So I'm like, I'm
going to keep you up at night anyway.
Well, and this is the stuff that Adam complains about, that I take too much input from people and stuff. And I'm like, but I do. And I'll take course. I'll adopt and adjust. And thank you for the feedback. They don't allow that anymore. That's not allowed.
What do you mean that's not allowed?
No one's given a second chance to adjust course. Everyone's just destroyed. That's it. You have to be destroyed now.
Yeah.
I've never seen – I would argue that there's been nothing like this since pre-revolutionary France where people are routinely put on the guillotines. Why? Because. No due process. I mean, think about it.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, that's true.
The Soviets did it. If you sort of spoke ill of somebody in the Communist Party, you would lose your job. You didn't go to the gulag. You just lost your job. McCarthy did it. You just, if you were thought to be a communist, you'd lose your job. Boom, no due process. But even then, at least you had to come before a committee. Now you say something, you step in the wrong direction, you say something, you're immediately destroyed.
It's scary.
Immediately.
Yeah, it's scary.
Yeah.
Do you worry about that at all?
Yeah, because you literally anybody can destroy you.
Yeah.
Somebody who just doesn't like you or doesn't like something you said or what they say doesn't have to be factually true.
That's true. Yeah.
They just have to have a few people agree to it or say, yeah, that happened to me too. And that's it. You're done.
It scares me. I'm not a famous person.
When I say Me Too, I'm not talking about the Me Too movement per se. I'm talking about just any in whatever these sort of unforgivable sins we have today of language.
And the fact that you just had to clarify that is a full on example.
Right, right. And by the way, I have this weird relationship with this whole phenomena in that I like the fact that we're doing this and we're holding people accountable and we're you know, all this stuff is not bad. It's good. It's just excessive. The excessive sort of consequence that is going on and people being truly harmed that maybe shouldn't be harmed. And isn't that what our justice system is all about? Not harming people who aren't guilty?
Yeah, in theory.
Bottom line, that's our greatest concern. And we've just completely gone around that now.
Yeah, I mean the idea, and I gotta look up where this came from because we're gonna get emails about it anyway. But there's something like it's better that 100 guilty men go free than one innocent.
Right. I think it was like John Adams or something. It was way back.
It's gonna be one of those. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's our greatest preoccupation, and yet we've thrown that to the wind completely.
Yeah, it's terrifying.
Yeah.
It's terrifying.
I mean, think about it. You're better off with a manslaughter charge. You get your day in court. You know what I mean?
That's true.
You can return to work if you're not guilty. It's no harm, no foul.
Turns out Dr. Drew didn't kill that guy.
Yeah, right. Or it was an accident or whatever. Yeah. You're community service.
It's just negligence.
Yeah, right, right. Whatever. It's like No. It's instant beheading.
Yeah, good point. Yeah, you'd rather run someone over with your car just because it was raining and you couldn't see them than to be accused of some sort of other harassment
or some sort of
other transgression.
Transgression in the eyes of social justice warriors.
Before I let you go, I'm dying to know this, and I've always wondered this question actually. After you hang up with somebody, or let's say love line, after you hang up with somebody on the phone, how often do you think about that person after the show? Did that fade over the time? Over time, because I would think a lot of those calls, I would be haunted by them forever.
Some of them, some for a couple of days, I'd worry about or think about. Most of them were so the kinds of phenomena were so commonplace to me.
Sure, yeah.
That I know they're not in real danger. I hope they'll learn from it. I hope they'll go see their doctor or therapist or whatever. That they would. My greatest desire in any of these things is just motivate them to get help. I don't want them to think they're getting help. I want them to think I'm elucidating their situation and motivating them to get help and where to get help, what kind of help. That's all. So if I feel like I've done that effectively, there are times when if I can't think of anything specific, but if I didn't like hit it just right or if I didn't feel the person really heard me properly, I'll obsess about that a little bit.
Are there any that you remember even now where you still think about like two or three random just the all time? I don't want to say best of or favorite because that's kind of the opposite of what I mean. Anything that just haunts you that always has.
You know, we have – there's things I can – when people always ask those kinds of questions and so we sort of will pick a call.
Oh, I didn't
realize
that.
That's the one that we rehearse and we'll always put out. Gotcha. That's that one. But I can't think of anything that haunts me.
Yeah.
I can think of things I remember. I'm thinking right now of this guy that called us and wanted to know – women always freak out when they find out what I was in jail for. And we started talking. Maybe Adam was doing jokes and whatever. We started talking to him. And all of a sudden, Adam goes, wait a minute. Find out that you were in jail or find out what you were in jail for? He goes, what I was in jail for? And we go, oh, well, what were you in jail for? I broke into a mausoleum and I twisted off the head of an old lady and boiled it to a skull because I needed it for my little brother's snake's aquarium.
Wow.
And I thought, wow. And
wow.
You don't understand, that might be a little disturbing to people. Why?
Okay. So he was
psychopath.
Psychopath. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. That is unbelievable.
That's a haunting one. That kind of
thing. Yeah. That I can see.
I have another one. Now, funny that you, this feeling, see, this is how I work is with feeling. So the feeling I'm having right now is what it feels like to talk to a psychopath. I remember we had another caller, kid that called in and said, I think I'm a psychopath. And I go, why? And he describes psychopathy. And I said, well, look, good. You can work with that. You can accommodate it. It's if you are feeling aggressive and violent and you don't, appreciate other people exist, it can get you in real, real trouble. But you should, go talk to somebody, learn how to develop some mechanism. It probably won't be empathy, but some way of managing this liability. And people do. 10%, what was it? What percent? 1% of the population?
I think it's 4%.
Yeah. So there are people out there walking around like that. And provided they
were 1%. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. Provided they weren't abused when they were kids and provided they're sort of otherwise sort of healthy, they can accommodate it. Do you ever interview – you should interview James Fallon.
James Fallon. I was going to ask if you saw that I interviewed him. It was really fascinating.
Great? Isn't he a great interview?
He was a great interview. Yeah. And the fact that he had made been able to make the distinction between what creates a harmful psychopath versus a functional psychopath.
And he sort of tilts at the idea that there's different kinds of psychopaths that have not yet been fully characterized. In his case, in his family's history of psychopathy, and psychopathy is a genetic biological thing, they kill their family members.
Right, yeah.
Isn't that crazy?
When I interviewed him, what he told me was, he goes, so I rushed home to tell my wife, and what she said was, I'm not surprised at all.
And then he said he went to his kids, they're like, we know you're an asshole. You're an asshole. And so he then started paying attention, and he realized he treats his family like crap.
Yeah.
But the rest of us, he's charming and entertaining. He sort of adopted that style.
Yeah, yeah. I asked him if that style was something he'd always been like, and he said, but that's because smart psychopaths, they're nice, they're charming, they're outgoing, they're charismatic because it works better.
Oh,
and that was a little bit scary, and he didn't really realize why that was scary.
You know,
you are a true psychopath.
Right.
Yeah.
And he had a weird thing, too, in his adolescence where he became hyper-religious.
Oh,
did he tell you about this?
Yeah.
And as it was some sort of compensation or something for this.
Like super Catholic.
Crazy religious, like over the top.
Yeah, that makes sense. I read that in his book, and I didn't really put those two things together like that, but it makes sense that it was compensation.
He told me he felt it might have been some compensation for what he was dealing with.
Yikes. Yeah, that he was a fascinating interview. We'll link to that in the show notes just in case people are new to
this particular episode. You can't get enough of James Fallon.
Absolutely. Yeah. Dr. Drew, thank you so much.
My pleasure. It's only taken us, you'd say it's Tuesday, that's 7 years to get here.
Yeah, so. We'll do another one hopefully sooner than that.
Fair enough.
So there we go. Dr. Drew, only took us 7 years, Jason.
Yeah, seriously. Talk about a scheduling snafu to get him on the show. But man, I tell you what, this guy's intuition is so sharp that he just doesn't even know he has it at this point. It's like he's done so many of those calls and seen so many patients in the real world that he can just like narrow in with laser focus on the problem with just vocal tonality over the phone. And the whole thing with the person with multiple personalities blew my mind. That he's that good and so attuned to what people need in the instant. It's crazy.
Yeah, it's really next level incredible. I know people are like, oh, well, you know, all this and then just celebrity rehab. I mean, we talked about that on the show, but it really, he's just an incredible guy all around. And a great big thank you to Dr. Drew. He's just such an awesome dude. Like, of course, I'm fanboying out, which is fine. I don't care. As you all maybe know, I am a regular on Adam and Drew every month on their shows, which, as you can imagine, is also kind of just every day I sit in that studio. I'm just like, what is going on right now? I can't believe it. You know, it's like I'm on Loveline, only I'm in studio with these guys taking callers. It's incredible. So that's just a lot of fun. And this sort of come full circle has been awesome for me in the past couple weeks. So great big thank you to Dr. Drew, of course, for everything, not just this show, but for influencing my entire career path and life. How's that? If you enjoyed this one, don't forget to thank Drew on Twitter as well. Tweet at me your number one takeaway here from Dr. Drew. I'm at Jordan Harbinger on both Twitter and Instagram. And don't forget, if you want to learn how to apply everything you heard from Drew, make sure you go grab the worksheets also in the show notes at jordanharbinger.com/podcast. This episode was produced and edited by Jason DeFilippo. Show notes are by Robert Fogarty. Booking, back office, and last-minute miracles by Jen Harbinger, and I'm your host, Jordan Harbinger. The fee for the show is that you share it with friends when you find something useful, which should be in every episode. So please, share the show with those you love and even those you don't. We've got a lot more in the pipeline, and we're very excited to bring it to you. In the meantime, do your best to apply what you hear on the show so you can live what you listen, and we'll see you next time. By the way, I know I've mentioned this before, but it's worth repeating. I've created a course of essentially a lot of the things I wish I'd known 10 years ago about networking, relationships, a lot of the practices I do every day, the little daily drills, how to re-engage weak and dormant ties, reach out to influencers, reach out to random people that I want to get in touch with for any reason. And I put that all into a little free course that we call Level One, and you can get that for free. It's just me on camera doing some videos, sending you some worksheets, and teaching you this stuff, a dozen videos or so. Go to advancedhumandynamics.com/level one. That's advancedhumandynamics.com /level1. Again, it's free. It's really just stuff I wish I knew a long time ago and that will help anybody personally or professionally. It's also the beginning of what I've been teaching military, special forces, corporations, bodyguards, all that kind of cool stuff. And it's really important for men and for women, for adults and for kids, and for your professional and personal life. It is really just clutch networking and relationship development skills. So go and grab that at advancedhumandynamics.com/level1 and let me know what you think.